Well, okay. Yeah, I haven't seen him around in a little bit because I think he took general relativity here. I want to say it was around 2005, somewhere in that neighborhood. It was one of the first times I offered it, so it's been a little while. And last time I saw him was maybe a couple years ago. But anyway, it's very well written notes, and he's still around. He doesn't move around very well. He had to have his kneecap removed with surgery, so he's always in a wheelchair. Well, let's start off. We're talking about manifolds. We're still in chapter 2. And the first thing we're going to talk about is this part called vectors again. And later on, we're basically going to go all the way through, I think, section 2.5. And then after 2.5 is when we actually get into things like differential forms. And that's why I thought it's useful to kind of look at these supplementary notes. To help you out with that. So the idea here is to kind of reintroduce vectors in the framework of manifolds. And before we talked about vectors, in the traditional, you've got a flat space, and now we have things that could be curved or have different geometries. So if you have a function which maps a manifold to a set of real numbers, and it's infinitely differentiable, we say that this is basically is basically what happens when you're dealing with these manifolds and you're going from a map of that to a set of real numbers. Then a tangent space at a point P in the manifold is going to be defined by directional derivatives. And so a directional derivative is like when you're taking a gradient. And so, for example, if you take something and you're taking a derivative in a certain direction, you have a scalar value, you take a derivative in a certain direction, then you have basically that's a directional derivative. And so you go basically from the function f to df d lambda at point p, which is parameterized by something called lambda. And here I'm not saying lambda is space or time or whatever, it's just some parameter. And so you're just saying that f changes with lambda at point p by this amount. You can also parameterize by eta as well as lambda, in which case you've got this function, this coordinates, x of mu parameterized by lambda and x of mu parameterized by eta, and you can turn that into a derivative respect to lambda and a derivative respect to eta, as you can see here. And so and you can see that these are all scaled by some real numbers, scalar values a and b here. And you can also apply a chain rule where you might have derivatives respect to lambda and respect to eta acting on two functions f and g, and you get this chain rule of all these derivatives. And then you can go through the chain rule terms and you can group them together so you have all of this acting on g and all of this on f. And so all this has to basically come down from the fact that we had an infinitely differentiable function f which mapped from our manifold to our set of real numbers. And so if you can actually look at derivatives of your mapping function. And so that's what we're really taking a derivative of.
And what does C infinity mean again?
Oh, that means it's infinitely differentiable.
Oh, in English. Okay.
Yeah, so basically you could take a first derivative, a second derivative, a third derivative, all the way out to infinity, and nothing ever blows up. Nothing is discontinuous. And I guess the way I would picture that graphically is this is infinitely differentiable on the surface because you can differentiate everywhere on here and get an answer. But this is not infinitely differentiable because it doesn't connect here. So you can't just go from here to here smoothly. Okay? So that's the difference between infinitely differentiable and not infinitely differentiable. But on the other hand, you can make this into something like a torus or something like this. That's infinitely differentiable. And so when we're talking about these derivatives, we're really talking about derivatives of the function defining the map, not the manifold itself, which is an easy thing to forget. So, in this case, x mu is a coordinate, which can be mu goes from, covers all the space and time indices, so this could represent a coordinate anywhere in space-time. And the partial respect to mu, this thing here, is basically a partial derivative. And it is forms the basis of T sub P, which means the space of tangential points to the surface. So if we take phi, and we call phi a map that goes from the manifold to a set of real numbers in dimensions, and gamma is basically a map that goes from a set of real numbers to something on the manifold, or it basically just follows a one-dimensional curve, or maps to a point, however you want to think about it. And so this is basically a curve parameterized by lambda. And f is a function that goes from the manifold to another set of real numbers. Then you can put all this together and you can get this picture, where you can see here you've got real numbers that are somehow mapped to a curve on the manifold. And this is sort of like I can give you a bunch of numbers, and these numbers could represent coordinates on a map. If I, it could be latitude and longitude, or they could be street addresses and mapping to a particular street. Whatever it is, it just maps to this curve. And then you can also map from this curve on the manifold through some other function to another set of real numbers. In which case, maybe these are latitude and longitude, maybe these are street addresses. They don't even have to be the same. And then you can also map from this manifold down to this flat map, which you might pull out and use to plot your course. Or you can map from these real numbers to the flat map, and from the flat map back up to a set of real numbers. And so there's this interplay going on between all of these. And so you got all these functions, like function f, which basically tell you how to get from one to the other. And you can combine functions or whatever you want to go from one transformation to another. And you could see here that if you take the derivative of your function, f in this case, that is the same thing as taking the derivative of the function combined with this other function to go from real number to real number.
You mean you do it twice, sort of in one difference?
Yeah, it's kind of like you basically say here that instead of just taking, since this is a function and it really is real numbers, that these two are equivalent because you basically have to go from real number to real number. Okay.
You can do that with the shuttle's orbital reference frames.
Mm-hmm.
Or I know I've even seen it somewhere where like it just gets converted, or like when I'm doing years on a computer, it gets converted to this absolute number, and then I can write it out in June or June 20th. I can write it out in a gazillion different ways, but it goes into an absolute manifold in the center.
Yeah. And then it gets converted back out. And we really do this all the time, because if I say, give me a position, and you give me a position like 5, And I say, give me a velocity, and it's going to be like 2 meters per second. That means at this position, which is this set of real numbers, you map it over, taking the derivative of it, and end up with another set of real numbers. So position and velocity can be thought of as both these sets of real numbers. That's why this is combined here. And you can take this, and you can write this as if you've basically gone, instead of this path of going from real number straight to real number, you can look at it as if you've taken this path and you've gone from real number through the manifold down to your coordinate map, and then from this coordinate map back up to this other real number. And so it doesn't matter which path you take, you basically are going real number in to real number out, or set of real numbers in to set of real numbers out, however you want to think about it.
Is the order of the combining the functions to commute, or does it look better?
It does not commute. Well, the reason, I can't remember exactly why they write it like this, but I think that they tend to write the second one first and then the first one. And I don't know if that's a convention or if there's a special significance to it.
Okay. Because following the map that you've drawn, that's an actual...
Yeah, because
you
got...
R, I would have done...
Yeah. Yeah, you would have probably done it the other way, gamma and then F, instead of the other way around.
So you're saying it's a convention to put the second one first?
I think that's it.
And just follow it, just accept it.
I mean, I haven't... I don't know. I don't think he really explained well in the book as far as why you would go this way as opposed to writing it the other way and combining these functions. But, yeah, anyway. So you can look at it now instead of just having... since you're basically going from combining F and gamma, you can go like this. And then, or basically from here to here, and then from here up to here, which is what they're expressing right here. In which case, now you've got a derivative with respect to this, and a derivative with respect to this. And so what they did here was they wrote this by using the chain rule, where you've got basically a derivative of this with respect to lambda, and then you've got the derivative of this with respect to the coordinate, because basically this first term, this first transformation, changed you to a flat map where you have coordinates. And then you have to take a derivative of the coordinates to get you back up here. And that's why this is a partial respect to the coordinate, as opposed to being just a partial respect to lambda. Because here we're parameterized by, here you're parameterized by lambda, and here you're parameterized by the coordinate. Does that make sense? And so what they did next was they said, well, this is the same thing, effectively, as if you just took a derivative with respect to the coordinate, or the derivative of the coordinate with respect to lambda, and then took a derivative of the function with respect to the coordinate. Yeah?
Yeah, up in your diagram, lambda isn't up there anymore.
Lambda is just stated as how this is parameterized here. And it kind of comes from this statement here that says that F is parameterized by lambda.
And that's what that little swish, that little sort of Nike swish is.
Oh, this thing is actually, this is the coordinate path. We actually aren't showing lambda. Yeah, that's the manifold. So we're not actually showing lambda on here. And then we're basically, once we get down to this point, and we actually believe this, which is, you know, makes sense, because, you know, this is a function, and phi is really not a function, and so you can kind of have the phi and the inverse phi and not even really think about those. But this is going to tell you something about the coordinates. This is the function. And so you can basically say then that since this is equivalent to this, that partial respect to lambda It's the same thing as taking a derivative of the quotient in respect to lambda times a partial respect to the derivative, which is just chain rule, what you expect when you're taking derivatives, like calculus of variations or something. And this derivative, this partial derivative, is the coordinate basis for your tangent space. They have a lot of words at the bottom, which basically say that the coordinate basis vectors are not always normalized to unity or orthogonal. On a curved manifold, the coordinate basis is never orthonormal throughout the neighborhood of a point where curvature doesn't vanish. Okay, so in other words, it's saying that usually when we think of coordinate bases, we think of x and y and they're orthogonal to each other and they're orthonormal. But in general, they're not always going to be they're not always going to be normalized to unity. And if you look at, for example, spherical coordinates, you've got r, theta, and phi. Those are not always unit vectors. And on a curved coordinate basis, you're never going to have orthonormal vectors everywhere, especially where the curvature doesn't vanish. And that is kind of the key to understanding curvature, is that when you don't have things that are orthonormal, that's how you know you got curvature. All right, so let's talk a little bit about transformation laws. All right, so let's take two different coordinate systems. We've got the primed and the unprimed coordinate system. And here you've got the derivative with respect to the primed coordinate system. And you can transform this just like a vector or a dual vector or a one form or whatever you want to call it, by basically taking the partial of one coordinate with respect to the other coordinate and then multiplying it by that vector. So we can transform from having a partial derivative with respect to one coordinate to a partial derivative with respect to another coordinate. And so this is the same thing. Since these are the basis, if you contract the vector with the basis, it's the same result no matter which coordinate system you're talking about, since these are both scalars. And so you can kind of throw in the transformation into here and see that the vector transforms like this. So the vector, same thing as we've always done before. And so you can write the transformation of a vector. In this case, it's a contravariant vector as this, where you have the derivative of a coordinate system respect to another coordinate system times the vector gives you the other one. And so these are more general than Lorentz transformations. They can be nonlinear. They always work, though. Another thing I want to introduce, and we're kind of building up to something, so I'm doing a lot of introductions here, is this thing called a commutator. And you guys might remember this from quantum mechanics, or they're like Poisson brackets in classical mechanics, where if x and y are vector fields, then the commutation operator of x and y acting on some function f, these are called linear operators, so that this is the same thing as x acting on y of f minus y acting on f of x. And so if this comes out to be zero, then that means that the order of x and y doesn't matter applied to your function. Vector fields are these basically functions which can map smooth functions over all the manifold by taking a derivative of every point. And so an example of this is if you look at a electric field or a magnetic field, then electric field at everywhere in space, you've got one value of the electric field. And it's a smooth function because it continuously goes from one value to another. You don't have a really high electric field pointing in the x direction right next to a really high electric field pointing in the y direction without some transition between the two. So they're smooth and they're continuous. And they can also be used to map, basically, they exist all over the manifold, so you can, they're like you're taking a derivative, in a way, to get a vector field. Because just like derivatives, or these directional derivatives, they have a direction to them. And so vector fields map smooth functions to smooth functions all over the manifold by taking a derivative, is the way we're going to look at them here. And so this commutation relationship here looks a lot like what we have up here. But now, these are different types of operators. Like here, we didn't specify what kind of operators we were dealing with for x and y. Here, these are now vector field operators. And when they act, what happens is this is going to tell you you have x in the lambda direction and a partial derivative in the lambda direction acting on y in some other direction minus the opposite. And so it's basically like you're taking derivatives, but then you're forcing these derivatives to point in the direction of the other vector. And if there's not a difference, then the commutation vanishes.
And lambda is still the parameterization.
Yeah. Lambda, in this case, is the parameterization because you're... you could think of lambda here as the direction, not so much a parameter. So lambda could represent the x direction, y direction, z direction, time, whatever.
Okay, all right.
So it's not really parameterized by it like we were before. And so you notice here that if you put x and y and you said that they were partial derivatives, then they would commute. Because if, let's say, these were all partial derivatives, then you would have a partial derivative with another partial derivative, which gives you that box operator. And then you'd have a partial derivative in the mu direction. And then this would be the same thing, a box operator and a partial derivative in the mu direction. So if x and y are the same operator, or if they're partial derivatives, they commute. But you can imagine you can put in some function where it doesn't commute. All right, so this takes us back to tensors. Since we've talked about vectors again, we're kind of building back up to tensors. And what happens here is omega, in this case, is going to be something which is going to map this tangential space to a set of real numbers. And df is basically going to be the gradient of this function f that we talked about before, and it's going to be called a one-form. And you'll hear this referred to later a lot more, and especially if you look at that differential forms right up ahead of you. And taking a derivative with respect to lambda is a vector. And what happens when you combine a one-form and a vector is you end up with getting a scalar. In this case, you've got, you know, df d lambda, which is going to be a scalar value. The gradients of coordinates, which is this dx mu, are going to form a natural basis for the tangential dual space. And this is going to be because... we have these basis vectors for the covariant vectors or the dual vectors or whatever you call them. And they're automatically going to be such that when you contract them with a regular vector, you're going to get a delta function. So if you get a basis for these guys, if these are bases and you contract them with something and you get, and they're like an inverse of that basis, then these also have to be bases. And so in other words, you have gradients of the coordinates and they're going to form a natural basis, the same way that the partials that we had here form a coordinate basis. And the only difference is that one set you're talking about in the dual space, and the other set you're talking about in a regular tangential space. So when you have something like this, where you have this partial derivative which forms a basis of tangential space, and you have this gradient which forms a basis for the dual the dual tangential space, then you combine the two together and you get this thing, which forms a delta function. And so we can say then that this here is a function which mapped our tangential space to our real numbers, and it is going to be made up of this coefficient and this basis. And if you change the coordinate system from the unprime to the prime, you can do a coordinate transformation just like this, just like we've always done before. And here you can see that that also means that the coefficient can change with the coordinate system. So what we can do then is we can take this thing, a tensor, and we can think of it as being an operator on all these bases, whether it's the dual basis or the regular tangential space basis. And so to transform a tensor from the old unprime coordinate system to the new coordinate system, you've got all these partials in here, where these are basically transforming each element by transforming the basis. Does that make sense? I've got an example in here that'll hopefully illustrate this. This is one of those things where it takes a little bit of soaking in because it's so foreign. But once you start really working with this stuff, it seems like, it, even though it's like a different language, it starts to click a little bit. So we're going to look at a 0-2 symmetric tensor. And 0-2 means that you've got two lower indices, no upper indices. And in this case, this symmetric tensor is going to be 1, 0, 0, x squared. Okay? So when you have a two-component matrix, you can literally write it like a matrix. It's not too hard to do that. And so we can kind of go back and forth between the tensor way of looking at it and the linear algebra way. And so S is basically comes from when you combine this tensor with the bases for it. In this case, we've got these dual bases, since these are lower indices. And when you combine this by linear algebra with these two components, the result is going to be, let's see, you've got 1, 1 is just 1, which it would be if this is 1 and this is 1, so you have dx squared. And then the cross terms are 0, so there's no mix between x, y. And then for you, and then for 2, 2, you have x squared and then dy squared. Okay? Can everybody see how that happened? Okay, well, think about it like this. You've got 1, 0, 0, x squared. And so, and you've got dx mu and dx nu, okay? So that means you have dx1, dx2, or dy, and I guess you could make this 0 and this 0. And then, so this, these two should represent two vectors, basically. So we would have, I guess it would be like this. And then, they're supposed to be, they're combined together. So, I guess this would be dx, dx, dy, dy. Oh, let me not do the linear algebra way. I'm just going to try to do it a little bit simpler than that, okay? Well, what happens is you've got S11 plus times dx1 dx1 plus S12 dx1 dx2 plus S21 dx2 dx1 plus S22 dx2 dx2. And all of that is the same thing as taking this. Okay? Because what you're doing is you're summing over the like indices. So if this mu is 1, then that's 1. If this is 2, then that's 2, etc. And so what happens is S11 is just 1. And then this is going to be 1 times dx times dx. For this, S12, that's 0. S21 is 0. And then S22 is x squared, and so then that would be dy, dy. And so the result is going to be dx squared plus x squared dy squared. You get it? So when you do that, you're basically just saying we're just using our tensor notation to rewrite this thing in terms of a scalar by combining the basis and the duals. So now, if we choose our coordinate difference so that x prime is going to be equal to 2x over y, and y prime is going to be y over 2, and we're going to assume that x is greater than 0 and y is greater than 0, so we don't have to deal with any negative numbers, then you can say that x is equal to 1/2 x prime y, and y is equal to 1/2 or 2 y prime. And you could further combine this, because you want to just have a transformation where you're just going to have the primes on one side and the unprimes on the other side. And so you can just take x is equal to x prime y prime by substituting the y into here, and y is equal to 2 y prime. Then you could take the derivative of each of these equations. So you have dx is equal to, from the chain rule, y prime dx prime plus x prime dy prime. And dy would be equal to 2 times dy prime. And then the idea is that you take this and you plug it back into here. And the result is going to be S is equal to all of this junk squared plus this term over here. And then what they've done then is they said, well, if the basis is going to be X prime and Y prime, then you can take all of this and you can rewrite it as a matrix like this. Because if you think about it, when you separate them out, you've got this term here is going to go with dx prime. This term, or dx prime for this term. This term is going to go with our dx prime dy prime. This last term at the bottom is going to be the dy prime dy prime, and then this is going to be dy prime dx prime. And so what happens is you could see that when you go through term by term, for the dx prime squared, there's only going to be this piece, right? Because that's the only place where dx prime squared shows up. You've got some cross terms that are going to come into account when you square this. So that's why you're going to get the y prime and the x prime. And you've got one from when you do dx prime dy prime, and then you have another one from dy prime dx prime. So that gives you the off-diagonal terms. And then from the dy prime squared term, it's just this. So you got 4, and then you got the x prime y prime squared. So we basically went from writing this thing as a matrix to writing it as a matrix. And so this is in the unprimed coordinates, the tensor. And then this is that same tensor in the prime coordinates. And so, you know, if you take this tensor here and you contract it with dx prime and dy prime, you will get back this, and then you change from the primes to the unprimes, and you'll get back to the exact same thing. So these are the same tensor, but written in a different coordinate system. And you notice here that that originally we had a symmetric tensor, and then after we did this coordinate transformation, it's still symmetric. And for most tensors, the symmetry and all that is not going to change when you do your coordinate transformation. The only exceptions to this are the metric, the partial derivatives, and the Levi-Civita, which are not... the metric is a constant tensor, which means it is unaffected by coordinate transformations. And we'll talk more about that later. Partial derivatives, we'll talk about why it is that they're different when you're talking about different curve space. And Levi-Civita is not a tensor, it's a symbol. Okay. All right, any questions on this example? And this is just a quick, brief example how to do some of the tensor math, because, you know, we just contracted this stuff and then wrote it all out. But the idea here is you can look at it from the point of view of linear algebra, you can look at it from the point of view of tensors, and either way is equally valid. Now, for partial derivatives, if we look at this case where you've got a partial derivative acting on a dual vector, that's the same thing as taking a derivative with respect to a coordinate and acting on, or in the prime coordinate frame, acting on the dual vector in the prime coordinate frame. Now, if you expand this out, you could see that now you have here, this is where you do the coordinate transformation on the unprimed coordinate. And this is where you do the coordinate transformation on the unprimed derivative of the coordinate. Now, what has to happen is that this partial derivative not only acts on this vector here, it also has to, or this dual vector, it also has to act on the coordinate transformation. And so you got this first term, which is what you'd expect, and then you have this extra ugly term where you're actually taking a derivative of this thing here. And you'll notice if you talked about just going from Cartesian to Cartesian coordinates in flat space, this last term would disappear because it's just ones down the diagonal, in which case you just have this as the whole coordinate transformation. And so the lesson from this is that you have this extra piece, and that extra piece is going to depend on the partial derivative of the transformation matrix, it's therefore not a tensor and doesn't transform as a tensor does. Because if you change the partial derivative of the transformation matrix, then it's going to change whatever the outcome is here. And so it doesn't transform like a tensor. And so one thing, when we get to curvature, we'll talk about how do you deal with that. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is the metric. And the idea here is that the metric is a symmetric 0-2 tensor, so it just has two lower indices. And it's usually non-degenerate. So what happens is if you take the inverse metric and the metric, you can switch the order and you end up getting a delta function. And this thing and its inverse are used to raise and lower indices. And then the other uses of it are it can help define the notion of past and future, because you know you can use the metric to define space-time intervals, and so it can tell you what's the full interval of space-time and whether something happened in the past or the future. It allows the computation of path length and proper time by, you know, space-time intervals. It determines the shortest distance between two points. And later on, we're going to use it to replace the Newtonian gravitational field. And so this will be like the thing that we'll use to really talk about what the field is doing. It provides a notion of locally inertial frames. And so it can tell us whether or not we're in a locally inertial frame. It determines causality because it can be used to, again, tell space-time distances between events. And it replaces the dot product when you're talking about a non-trivial space-time. In flat space, we would write ds squared, the distance between two events in a space-time, using this eta, where we've got here these derivative terms, which form the basis in dual space, and you've got eta here. In general space, we're going to use g instead. And so in Cartesian coordinates, ds squared we know is going to be x squared plus y squared plus z squared. But if you use spherical coordinates, where x, y, and z are written in terms of r, theta, and phi, then you have dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus r squared sine theta squared d phi squared. And so both of these are equivalent, but if you're talking about dealing with the surface of constant curvature like the Earth, then this is also going to be a lot more handy for calculating arc length along a sphere. Now the metric, if you put the metric and you contract it with two vectors, in this case I'm using two contravariant vectors, then you can write that as if it's acting on both of these vectors, and it's the same thing as basically taking the length of the vectors, or the dot product of the two vectors, and so we can write it like this sometimes. Now the signature of the metric is usually written as like whether you have positive or negative signs, and from general relativity, usually we put time as being negative and all the other dimensions as positive. But you can flip that around and everything still works mathematically. And so it's just kind of choosing which signature you want to do and whether you're going to have positive or negative eigenvalues. In Euler or Riemann geometry, you're just going to use positive, which basically means, like in most of the geometry you're used to when you're just talking about three-dimensional vectors, you just have the positive terms here, which represent space. In Lorentzian or pseudo Riemannian geometry, you're going to have one minus sign, which means time is included and it's special. And then you can also have this indefinite geometries where you might have some positive and some negative. So you might actually have more than one time dimension, and you can actually create a space-time where you actually have more than one time dimension. Now, when we say locally inertial coordinates, what we mean is that we're going to do a coordinate transform on the metric and on the space-time. So we're basically going from our curved manifold to make it look as if at least in one little local space it's flat. And that is basically going from a special geometry, a special coordinate system, at a special point P where this looks like flat space, Minkowski space. It's not going to be true everywhere, but at least you could transform it down to one point. And that's sort of like what we do when we take a globe and we make it into a map. And we're just taking that whole curved space and we're just doing some kind of transformation operation to make it look locally flat. And in the local Lorentz frames, when you take partial derivatives of this metric in this flat space-time, you're going to get zero because this thing is constant. But what happens, though, is that the second derivatives are not going to be zero of the metric. And so what's happening is you're basically creating this illusion that it looks locally flat, but in reality, it can never, you know, you can only go so far with it. You can make it look locally flat, where you locally it looks like Minkowski space, but if there's curvature there, there's always going to be curvature there. In which case, the second derivative is not going to vanish, even though the first derivative vanished. And so this is how we can tell whether or not we're really in a flat space or if we're in a curved space. And this is like the real test of, you know, we're really in a gravitational field. We're not just in an accelerating frame. And so this is what that means and what that's going to be useful for. Now, what we've done is we take our metric and we do a coordinate transformation on the metric in the usual way with the derivatives of the different primed and unprimed coordinates. And what we're going to do is we're going to expand it like a Taylor series. And this is just an example here of how do you Taylor expand some coordinates, where we're Taylor expanding them around some point P. And you can see here around point P, you've got this, you're taking all these derivatives at the point P. And so you're expanding, first just that coordinate by itself, and then you got the coordinate with in a couple dimensions, and then kind of coordinate three dimensions, and you're just expanding out. And then you can assume here that if you take your coordinate and you say that in both dimensions they're zero, which means you're basically at the origin, you know, you can simplify all this. Well, we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to expand the metric here out in terms of everything. And what happens then is you've got your metric, you've got your first derivative of the metric at that point, and you got your second derivative of the metric at that point. And you're really expanding this whole transformation matrix. And so what happens then is you're going to group all these together, where here, the first part here is you're taking the terms without any coordinate x. And then you got the expansion with 1x, and then you got the expansion with x double prime. And so you can set these equal to each other in equal values of x. And so basically it's the same type of expansion you're doing up here, but now you're having the metric expanded. And so this is where things get a little complicated, because when you set equal values of x, then what you'll see here is that this new metric that you have at point P are going to be determined by the coordinate transformation. And this is going to be a 16 element matrix, if you want to think about it like that, because you've got four dimensions of space-time in a 4x4 matrix, and so that means 16 elements. Well, what happens is, since it's symmetric, you can kind of lower this down to 10 elements. But now, for the second derivative, or first derivative term, you can set the first derivative to zero so it looks like Minkowski space locally, or flat space locally. And for that term, you've actually ended up with 40 total terms on the right-hand side, because you've got those 10 elements from here, and then you're taking derivatives of those over four dimensions, so that's four times 10, which is 40. And so you have to set those 40 equal to 0. And then you've got, on top of this, you've got your second derivative, which I don't mention here. And what happens is, in the second derivative, you've got a total of 100 possible numbers. Because you've got 10 elements for the metric that are non-degenerate. And then you basically got two derivatives acting on it, so that's like another 10 elements, because it's like a metric times a metric to do all this. So you have 100 total numbers that you can deal with. But what happens is, when you look at the symmetry for that second derivative term, and you have something like this, where you have all three of these derivatives going on, then what happens is you've got 20 different possibilities from that, and you got to multiply that by the four possible dimensions that could be on the top, and so you end up with about 80 degrees of freedom of adjusting this thing. And when you take the 100 possible total numbers minus the 80 degrees of freedom, you end up with 20 left. Which means that you cannot make the second derivative go to zero as simply as you could the first one derivative. And so you can't just get rid of curvature, and so that means that these 20 degrees of freedom that won't vanish are what's going to define curvature later on in the next chapter. Meanwhile, you know, like I said, you can get rid of the first derivative. You just can't get rid of the second derivative. And that's going to be used to characterize the Riemann tensor, which is going to turn out to have 20 independent components in four dimensions. So anyway, to recap real quick, it's basically, you know, they go into a lot more detail on this on page 74 and 75. But the basic idea was, if, you know, can you coordinate transform a metric in a general space-time, you know, like say, like take a sphere, like the globe, and make it look flat. And let's say you even go so far as to flatten it out and just concentrate on one little area, can you make it look flat? And what this is saying is that, yes, you can make the first derivative disappear, but you can't make the second derivative disappear. And so even if you flatten it out and you just look at that one tiny area, you're still going to be able to tell that there's some curvature going on, which means you could still tell there's gravity. And it's going to come down to the fact that geometrically, you can't get rid of all of the different degrees of freedom in order to make it work. I don't think it was that well explained in here either, so it's a confusing topic, and they kind of bring this up early, I think, to kind of get your mind thinking a little bit about it before they really explain it later on. So, it's real foreshadowing. Now, as an example, what does an observer measure as ordinary 3 velocity? And so the thing is, if you're looking at flat space, we already know what 3 velocity is. And we have to think about, well, what happens in curved space? What's 3 velocity then? Well, what you do is you transform your space, whatever geometry you happen to be in, into a locally inertial coordinates, which means flat space. And then you set the observer in the rest frame of that space. And so your observer is going to be here at rest, where they're moving forward in time but not in space, is their 4 velocity. And then this rocket or whatever it is that they see moving is going to be moving in the x direction. And gamma is the traditional gamma, 1 over square root of 1 minus v squared. And so what's happening here is that you can think of gamma, then you can calculate gamma as being taking the dot product of the two vectors, the four velocity of the rocket and the four velocity of the observer, and putting a minus sign in front. And you can see mathematically why that should work out. Well, this is just this dot product. And so if you take that and you plug it in to here for our inverted equation showing velocity written in terms of gamma, then you could see that velocity is just going to be equal to square root of 1 minus the dot product of the four velocities to the minus 2 power. So this is velocity. Now, all you have to do is convert back to curve space by basically changing from having the dot product of these in the hat coordinate system to the general coordinate system. And what happens is when you convert back to curved space, this is still a dot product because this is still a scalar. And a scalar is a scalar. And so the result is going to be the velocity is equal to square root of 1 minus the four velocities of the two to the minus 2 power. And so because the contraction is the same in either coordinate system. So what happens is in curved space, when an observer sees an object moving and he measures three velocity, it doesn't matter whether he's in curved space or flat space, he's going to measure the same thing. And so this was just meant to just illustrate how do you deal with having to go back and forth between the general curved space that was going to be like living on the surface of a manifold and the flat space time that we're normally dealing with. Okay. So, any questions? Yeah, it's still early.
Well, I should be back at a work thing at 7:30. I can get there as late as 8.
Okay. Well, we don't have to stay too late if there's no questions, or if there's no questions on the homework.
Are you going to be around the office tomorrow?
I should be. I've got some work to do. I'll probably be working at the computer. All right, so next time what we're going to do is we're going to start, they have a kind of a toy model example of an expanding universe, and it's just kind of getting into examples of different manifolds that you might run into, and then there's some more about differential forms and things. But I think the important thing with this stuff is that it needs to soak in a little bit, because differential forms and these things are not easy concepts. And it's one thing it's always been frustrating for me in physics is that I always felt like we were never told the whole story up front. And it's kind of like, you know, you're told little bits and pieces, and then later on when you get the whole story, it's like, oh, now it all makes sense. And so, unfortunately, that's sort of the way that this has to be, is that, you know, you can't really get the whole story until you've seen everything, and then when you see everything, things kind of click. But as far as the stuff we're covering so far, the basic idea is to just kind of set up this idea of a curved space and manifold and how it's different than what you might be observing now. And then when you put it in, I think when we get to chapter 4 in this book, that's when everything comes together and says, oh, now there's gravity. Now that's why they have to do all this stuff.